Hello, I'm Brett Dillon, and this is The Movie Chronicles. In this episode, we examine the Marseille trilogy from playwright and director Marcel Pagnol. Scriptwriter Marcel Pagnol was born on February 28, 1895, in Albane, France, and he died in 1974. It was in 1904 that the Pagnol family rented the Bastide Nueve in the village of L'Etreil, province. Marcel's mother died in 1910, and his father remarried in 1912. In 1913, Marcel passed his baccalaureate in philosophy, and then attended the University of Aix-en-Provence. In 1914, war broke out like a rash. Marcel was conscripted, and then discharged in January 1915 as unfit for duty. In March 1916, he married. By the end of the year, he had graduated with a degree in English. Très bon. He became an English teacher. In 1922, Marcel and his family moved to Paris. While he continued to teach until 1927, he also began to write. His first success was a play written in collaboration with Paul Niveau and written in 1924. Marcel felt life in Paris was exiled from his beloved Provence. This sense nostalgia became the play Marius, which became his first film adaptation in 1931. This came about when Marcel, visiting London, England, saw an early talking picture and realized cinema was a format that he could use to increase his audience base exponentially. Marius became the first internationally successful French-language film. On the other hand, Marcel left the direction to Alexander Korda, and while not actively disliking the result, he decided he could do better. Marcel became famous for his careful casting of actors with the right accents for his films, and for highlighting French regional variations of culture. Tragedy struck in 1951 when his daughter Estelle died at the age of 2. Marcel retreated into himself and produced 4 memoirs of his early life. The sequence has the collective title Souvenirs d'enfance. In 1962, he published the L'Aude des Collines series and turned the first book, Jean de Florette, into a film. Marcel is buried near his childhood friend David Magnan, Lily de Ballon, in My Father's Glory. Marcel once observed, "One has to look out for engineers. They begin with sewing machines and end up with the atomic bomb." We open with the tale of the core character in the trilogy, Marius, 1931. Director, Alexander Korda. Script, Marcel Pagnol. Director of Photography, Theodore J. Pal. Editor, Robert Spiri Mecaton. Music, Francis Gromont. Actors, Raimu, Pierre Fresnay, Aurène Demazis, Fernand Chapin, Ali de Rouf, Paul Dulac, and Vassy. Marcel Pagnol was an enthusiastic proponent of film. It was an excellent mechanism to deliver his plays to a larger audience. For this film, he is part producer, part scriptwriter, and a supporter of director Alexander Korda, because Korda was disinclined to mess with Pagnol's words. This is a film of words. Its milieu of the port city of Marseille in France is full of characters who love to argue on the smallest pretext. Which brings us, perhaps, to the bravest aspect of the film. Marseille was one of the regional dialects of France. In preserving the accent for the film, Korda and Pagnol are making a bold statement to those who thought the introduction of sound in film meant a standard received accent. Regional accents need not apply because they would not be understood outside their region. Marius works for his father, César, at a wharfside bar in Marseille. He dreams of going to sea. His girlfriend is Fanny. She is being wooed by widower Panisse, much to everyone's amusement. Fanny comes to realize she cannot compete with the sea and encourages Marius to leave. The comic highlight is the film between Panisse and Marius, the moment he realizes he is in love with Fanny. This is performed as a tango. This is encapsulated in the single shot where Marius, in long shot, gets into Panessa's face. They then walk backwards, with the camera tracking them into a close-up of the two faces while they shout empty threats at each other. A close second for comic highlight is the card game. Pagnol's witty dialogue is allowed to shine. Korda helps this along by refusing to show us what cards are in the hands of the players. The plot is a melodrama, almost a soap opera in structure. We are asked to observe a society in macro that is firm and square through the eyes of a society in micro that is about to crumble. I like the way Aunt Zoe is held up to Fanny as an example of what not to do, to the point we suspect she has become a prostitute. When Zoe's story is finally revealed, it is much different from what we have been led to expect, and probably prefiguring the next film in the series, Fanny. Melodrama is appropriate for people who live in this hyper-reality. As an example, César shouts down the street to a friend not to tell anyone the ferry captain's wife has been cheating on him because the ferry captain is sensitive on this point. Korda adds an extra layer of comedy by having everyone on the street stop to listen in, expecting some new scandal, only to recognize they already know about it. Director Alexander Korda was born on September the 16th, 1893, in Turkev, Hungary, then part of Austria-Hungary, and he died in 1956. After the death of his father, Alexander became a film critic to support his family. He was excused military service due to his eyesight, and began World War I by editing film scripts through contacts he had made working through film magazines. In 1916, Alexander built his own production company, Corvin Film, which he built into one of the largest companies in Hungary. This was aided in part by the Hungarian Soviet Republic. The Republic was overthrown, and Alexander was imprisoned in 1919 under the White Terror that followed the fall of the Soviet. Upon his release, Alexander left Hungary and never returned. He left his homeland in a huff and landed in Vienna, Austria, due to an invitation from Count Alexander Kolovrat to direct the epic and, ultimately profitable, The Prince and the Pauper, 1920. The Count wanted a director with experience in imitating the Italian epic films of this period. He also wanted a director adept at special effects because actor Tibor Lubinsky was to play the two main roles. Despite this success, Alexander was not happy at the Count's studio, Sasha Film. He had to be annoyed at the Count's meddling in each project. In Hollywood, I think this process is still described as the producer pissing on a project to mark his territory. Alexander left the studio to work as an independent to make Samson und Delilah on a lavish scale, including a shooting schedule of 160 days. Needless to say, this film didn't make money. Next stop was Germany, where money was at least circulating to fund projects. Moreover, his wife, Maria Korda, was a star in Germany, making it easier to achieve financial backing by associating her name with the product. In 1926, Alexander moved to Hollywood. This was a fairly miserable period of his life. Alexander struggled to fit into the studio system, who pigeonholed him as a director of woman stars featuring exotic locales. To add to the stress, Hollywood was adapting to sound, and Alexander was having a hard time adapting with it. His hopes of making enough money to set up his own studio crashed with the Wall Street crash in 1929. By 1930, however, Alexander had learnt how to play the system. Paramount Studios sent him to France. He had almost immediate success by adapting Marcel Pagnol's play Marius, 1931, to the screen. With this success under his belt, Paramount sent him to England to create more magic. Instead, he created his own studio, London Film, and the rest, as they say, is history. Alexander became a naturalized English citizen in 1936 and was knighted for his services to the country, the first non-British producer to do so in 1942. He said, "It is not enough to be Hungarian, you must have talent too." In the 30s, he was a major guiding force in the development of the British industry. He learnt the craft by working his way through the studios in Austria, Germany, and the USA. He said, "The art of filmmaking is to come to the brink of bankruptcy and stare it in the face." He was criticised for spending much of World War II in the USA, yet it was subsequently revealed he was acting as a courier for Winston Churchill. He guided Charles Laughton on an Oscar for his performance as Henry VIII. He said of Laughton, "With him, acting was an act of childbirth. What he needed was not so much a director as a midwife." He also observed, "Anyone who gets a raw deal at a film studio is no more deserving of pity than someone who gets beaten up in a brothel. A gentleman has no business in either place." Actor Pierre Fresnaye was born on April 4, 1897 in Paris, and he died in 1975. Pierre spent 11 years with the Comédie Française. He broke into the big time working with Marcel Pagnol on the stage version of Marius. The major sticking point being Raimu, who didn't want to work with an actor who hadn't come from Marseille. Pagnol read the part in rehearsals while Pierre went down to work at a bar on the docks of Marseille. He then surprised everyone by turning up at the rehearsal with the right accent. This didn't stop Raimu making fun of the actor in this film when he mispronounces the word mother. Corda and Pagnol kept this ad-lib in, and if you watch closely, Pierre almost cracks up. Fanny made a big sacrifice for her man, but it has consequences in Fanny, 1932. Director, Marc Allegret. Script, Marcel Pagnol. Director of Photography, Nikolai Taporkov. Editor, Raymond Lamy and Jean Mamy. Music, Vincent Scotto. Actors, Raimu, Pierre Fresnaye, Aurain Damasis, Fernand Sharpen, and Auguste Maurice. Fanny opens immediately after the finale of Marius. Marius has followed his dream and run away to the sea on a 5-year voyage. César is heartbroken, and Fanny is sanguine. Then she learns she is pregnant. Her mother is horrified by the scandal, and it takes Fanny's aunt to make Hortense see sense. Fanny can't keep the secret from César, especially as Panisse has resubmitted his marriage offer. César counsels not telling Marius because he would come home and then resent her for the rest of his life. Hortense pressures Fanny to marry Panisse. She puts her foot down and refuses to even consider his offer until he knows the truth. If he renews his offer, then she will accept. She goes to his shop and confesses all. Panisse confesses he was unable to have children with his first wife, and, so long as no one knows, apart from Hortense, César, and presumably Marius, basically as long as the general public believe the child to be his, he'll happily marry her today. In due course, César Marius Panisse is born. Fanny learns, as the relatives arrive, that without the child, the Panisse family would end with this generation. When the child is 2 years old, Marius turns up. He has learnt of the child and demands his rights. He also confesses that his time away from Fanny has taught him how much he loves her. César and Fanny have to teach Marius some home truths. He is acting dishonourably towards Panisse in trying to take Fanny away from him. Panisse stood by Fanny even when he knew the truth, whereas Marius couldn't even stand by Fanny when he didn't know the truth. And while it is true Marius fathered the child, the real father is the man who gave his name to the child and has been with the child through sickness and health, joys and sorrows. Marius shouldn't be claiming to be filling an absence that doesn't exist. Marius comes to understand he must suffer the consequences of his decision, just as the others must. The film suffers from sequelitis. The blame falls mostly on director Marc Allegret, who, having the world of the film already built by Korda and Pagnol, concentrates his focus on the melodramatic elements of the plot. This leaves the comedy concentrated into two scenes: the sail of the boat nicknamed Submarine, and the scene in the park where César and Hortense are babysitting César Marius. The conversation is a game of brinkmanship, where each implies they know something about the child that might bring the other's happiness crashing down. It is César who twigs they're both sworn to secrecy on the same subject. Director Marc Allegret was born on December the 22nd, 1900, in Basel, Switzerland, and he died in 1973. Marc's initial interest was law. When he shifted to filmmaking, it was to pursue a career as a documentarian. He is credited with introducing the world to actors Jean Moreau, Simon Simon, and Brigitte Bardot. Director of photography Nikolai Topokov was born on June the 20th, 1885, in Moscow, Russia, and he died in 1965. Nikolai fled his homeland in 1917 to escape the revolution. He settled in France and became a stalwart of French cinema. He made his first two films in Russia in 1917 and started making films in France from 1919. Editor Raymond Lamy was born on August the 15th, 1903, in Pointe-à-Pitre, France, and he died in 1982. Fanny, 1932, was the second film that Raymond was in charge of editing. Today, he is best known for his work with Robert Bresson. Composer Vincent Scotto was born in Marseille on April the 21st, 1874, and he died in 1952. Vincent was a close friend of Marcel Pagnol. He was born in Marseille, and his career began in Marseille. He moved to Paris to get better opportunities to stage his operas, and had a sideline business of churning out 4,000 songs and 50 film scores. Actor Aurène Demasis was born in Oran, Algeria, and she died in 1991. Oran studied at the Conservatoire National Supérieur d'Art Dramatique, CNSAD, beginning in 1919. She constructed her stage name from the town of Oran and the nearby town of Mazis. Upon graduating, she performed at the Théâtre de l'Italia in Paris. She first met Marcel Pagnol in 1923. He wrote for her some of her most famous roles. She had a child, Jean-Pierre, to Marcel Pagnol in 1933. This was not Pagnol's first illegitimate child, nor his last. The years have passed as we pick up the story again. César, 1936. Director and script, Marcel Pagnol. Director of photography, Willy Faktorovich, Grisha, and Roger Ledru. Editor, Suzanne de Troyes and Jean Rogier. Music, Vincent Scotto. Actors, Raimu, Pierre Fresnay, Fernand Chapin, Aurène Demasis, Paul Dulac, and André Fouché. The Marseille trilogy ends with a whimper. I suspect I'm not the only one who feels this way. Marius has been made many times, as has Fanny. No one has remade César yet. The previous two films were adapted from stage plays. César was written as a film. César, although the title character, is not the focus of the film. This belongs to Ciro, his grandson. The film picks up 15 years after the events of Fanny. Panisa dies, and Fanny reveals to Cesaro who his real father is. Cesario tracks down a resentful Marius and reintroduces him to his family. Marius points out everyone got some benefits from the deal struck years ago, except him. He was banished from his family and exiled from the city of his birth. Perhaps I am unhappy with the film because of the happy ending. This closes off the trilogy, which is acceptable, by ignoring the issues this film in particular has brought up to the light, This is unacceptable. Cesario must wrestle with what a father is in terms of genetic heritage, which is a bit silly, as Cesario fears he may have inherited a propensity for criminal acts. Into this is added the class struggle. One of the reasons Marius didn't want to get back with Fanny is because it would be like sleeping with the boss's wife. As the trilogy has developed, it has included ever more location shots. In this film, it even goes so far as to include shots which link indoor and outdoor spaces, Fanny, for instance, opening the shutters to reveal the Maasai harbour. This sense of spaces and the use to which they are put is essential to Pagnol's scheme of revealing Maasai as a community. Perhaps I'm disappointed in Fanny. Her character hasn't developed in this film. Her passivity in Marius is understandable. In Fanny, she is sanguine and takes the hard choices. In César, I would have liked to see some fire. Age to the point she won't tolerate fools. There are some indications. For instance, when she learns Cesario has deceived her. Yet nothing comes of these indications. She needs to meet the fire of Marius and his whining with some fire of her own to teach him that she is his equal. Director of photography, Willy Fektorovich. There is some controversy over Willy's birthday and the place of birth. He was probably born on October the 3rd, 1888, in Kiev, Russia. He might have been born in Ukraine. He very definitely did die in 1960. It is also claimed he was born on November the 22nd, 1915, in Noilly-sur-Seine, France, and he died in 1987. Willy was in France by 1918, which is when his first film is recorded, which is why the last birth date came last. It's really improbable. He was a jobbing DOP with little of distinction to his name. He is associated with Marcel Pagnol and in the 1950s with helping to restore the reputation of Maurice Chevalier. Actor Raimu was born on December the 18th, 1883, in Var. He died in 1946. Raimu started his career in vaudeville imitating famous comics. He did a few silent films, but only found fame when he began working with Marcel Pagnol, who helped shape his working-class, good-natured yet cunning persona. Orson Welles described him as the greatest actor who ever lived. Next episode is a right carry-on in 1963. Chance would be a fine thing. Don't forget to purchase many of the fine Movie Chronicles ebooks from an e-store near you. Both 1930 and 1970 are well into pre-production as we speak. Until next time, remember, don't let a cabbie drive up your backside or let a sailor pull on your lanyard. At least, not without asking first.